Darkness descended upon the prairie.
All right, man. Mount up.
As quietly as they could manage, the patrol started toward the mouth of the ravine. The back way out was already deemed too severe a climb to make without causing a lot of noise. Anticipating such a move, Bloody Hand had sent part of his force close in to within about 50 yards of the ravine on foot. Crawling under cover of darkness, some had advanced even closer to the mouth of the gully, where the soldiers would try to exit. Unfortunately, Will Kaysen's prediction was swiftly confirmed. The first of the cavalry horses to clear the mouth of the ravine were shot down by Cheyenne warriors. The night became a blaze, lighting the darkness around them with the constant flashes of muzzles, causing the soldiers to fall back to the natural breastworks of the gully and take up defensive positions again. Bordeaux now fully realized the desperate position he was in.
Now at least we can hold them off. Now maybe if we make it too costly for them to try to overrun us, they'll decide we ain't worth the casualties.
Maybe. They know they got us outnumbered and figure we'll eventually run out of ammunition. What we need is to even the odds with a lot more soldiers.
Well now, why didn't I think of that? We'll just call for reinforcements.
Any chance you've got a bugler on this detail?
Barnhart's a bugler.
Other than blowing that bugle, is he a pretty good man?
Good as any of them, I guess. Why?
Might not work worth a damn, but at least it's something to try.
Will went on to explain what he had in mind. Bordeaux responded, somewhat skeptical, but with no plan of his own and his situation looking to worsen the longer they stayed pinned down in the ravine. He looked at Corporal Kincaid, who had stationed himself privy to the conversation.
You think it'll work?
I ain't paid to think, but it's better than sitting here waiting for him to get the nerve to rush us.
Oh, I'll get Barnhart over here.
Barnhart came when summoned.
You got your bugle with you?
I always carry it with me, sir.
Well, we got a little proposition for you, if you're willing. You might get your ass shot full of engine lead, but hell, ain't none of us gonna live forever.
Bordeaux went on to explain what he had in mind. Barnhart listened without apparent enthusiasm, but in the end, he agreed to give it a try. Will and Barnhart removed everything that might rattle or make any discernible noise from their saddles.
Come on, Barnhart.
Will started up the backside of the ravine, leading Spades. Passing two troopers stationed there, he continued up through the scattering of trees on the steep hillside, his eyes constantly scanning the darkness before him, with Barnhart close behind. They finally crested the hill and hurried down the other side, confident that they were in the clear. Feeling it safe to mount then, they rode up the neighboring hill to the top. That was as far as Will planned to go. There was nothing to do then but wait out the night.
Might as well make yourself comfortable. We got a couple of hours before sunup. Sleep if you want to. I'll be awake.
Sleep? I'd be afraid to close my eyes long enough to sleep. Damned if I can sleep with these hills crawling with those devils.
Hell, they're all surrounding that hole where the lieutenant is. You gonna be able to blow that thing when I tell you to?
I'll blow it, even though it ain't gonna do nothing but tell the damn engines right where we are.
Maybe, maybe not. You just blow it when the time comes.
At a little before dawn, things became quiet, and Will suspected that the Indian war chief was moving his warriors in preparation for an attack. He reached over to poke Barnhart with the toe of his boot.
All right, boy. Let's hear that bugle.
Bordeaux had ordered his men to fire into the air as Will had requested. Within a quarter of an hour, the Indians had vanished into the hills, thinking that the army was sending reinforcements. Robert Wilson walked out of the barn and stood staring toward the section across the creek where his sons, James and John, were working to clear a few acres of sage.
Might be a waste of time.
The soil was pretty dry and poor. At least he'd recovered the mule after the Indians had made off with his cow. And that was something else to think about. He had to have a cow, and there were not many places to get one.
I guess I'll have to go into Dodge and see if I can trade for one with some of the folks on their way west.
Robert shook his head at the thought. Dodge wasn't that far away, it was true, but he seldom left his farm to go anywhere. It wasn't often he saw strangers out his way as well. 2 hours earlier, the cavalry patrol had stopped to water their horses in the creek on their way back to Fort Dodge. Two of the soldiers were riding double. The lieutenant, Robert couldn't remember his name, told him of their encounter with the Cheyenne war party and told him he should be on the alert for any more signs of Indian activity.
Be on the alert? What the hell does that mean?
What the hell could he do against a bunch of savages that were too much for a cavalry patrol to handle? The lieutenant suggested that he might consider taking his family to the fort for a while until the army could do something to stop the raiding.
Hell, I can't do that. Who's gonna take care of my farm?
Ruth Wilson came walking up.
Who are you talking to?
Nobody. Just talking to myself.
You've been out in the sun too long. Where's your hat?
Her husband staggered back with the sudden impact of an arrow embedded in his chest. A second arrow took him in the stomach.
Ruth, run!
She thought of the shotgun inside the door of the house and she ran to get it. A blow from Brave Elk's war axe as he stepped from the corner of the house sent her crashing to the ground, only a few steps before reaching the door. As she lay dying, the last thing she saw were the slaughter of her two boys by the heathen Bloody Hand. Lying flat on his belly behind a scrub oak at the crest of a low ridge more than 200 yards away, Ned Spikes watched the bloody scene being played out at the farm by the creek. Afraid at first that he had stumbled into a Cheyenne war party, he resisted the natural urge to run and stayed to observe the raid. He was unwilling to believe there were only two Indians in the raiding party. But after lying there for the entire slaughter, he realized there were no more. So he remained where he was and waited while the family was murdered. He watched the warriors going into the house.
Don't set it on fire. There might be something in there I can use.
In a few minutes, he saw smoke curling up from the window.
God damn.
He was gratified, however, to see the two hostiles immediately jump on their horses and leave. Afraid to rush down to the farm immediately in case the two decided to return, he procrastinated for several minutes, weighing the danger of it against the possibility of salvaging something before the fire destroyed everything. With greed the deciding factor, he got on his horse and rode down to the farmyard. He surveyed the death scene, noting the bodies lying in the dust of the yard.
Damn, he's alive.
Ned went to the wounded man and knelt beside him.
Help me.
You're dying, mister, sure as hell. The rest of your family is already dead. Now, there ain't no reason to take any secrets to the grave with you. If you got some money hidden in that house somewhere, you might as well tell me where it is.
God, no money, for God's sake, help me.
It ain't gonna buy you nothing when you go to hell. Might as well tell me where it is.
Robert slowly shook his head. Ned shrugged.
I'll help you on your way. Now, let's see if there's anything in that damn house I can use.
Want to go to any old dance.
Sarah Lawton tied the sash on the little girl's dress.
It'll be fun. We'll meet some of the other families. They might have children your age.
I wish Will would come back.
I'd like to see Will again too, but I wouldn't count on it if I were you. He's busy scouting for the army, and I'm sure he'd visit if he was anywhere near here, but I doubt that'll happen. Now let me look at you.
Sarah held Emma at arm's length and smiled proudly.
just as pretty as a picture.
As much as her daughter, Sarah missed the soft-spoken rider of the wilderness. In the few short days they had spent together on the journey to Fort Dodge, she had developed a dependence upon his strength as well as a trust in his character. She told herself that it was a natural feeling toward anyone who'd saved her life and that of her child, unwilling to admit to herself that it just might go deeper than that.
Mama, there's a soldier coming.
Sarah turned to see a young officer striding from the camp confidently toward her wagon.
Lieutenant Braxton Bradley, ma'am, at your service. I've come to escort you and your daughter to the dance.
Properly impressed, Sarah was surprised. She was unaware that an escort would be arranged for her and Emma. It was obviously more of Edna Boyle's arrangements. The sergeant major's wife had been a frequent visitor in the past few days, sometimes accompanied by one of the officers' wives as they did their best to make Sarah feel that she was not alone.
How do you do? I must say, this is quite a surprise, one I hadn't expected. Well, it is a pleasure to meet you. This is my daughter, Emma.
For the child's benefit, he gallantly took Emma's hand, bowed, and kissed it.
Did Edna Boyle send you by chance?
Not at all, ma'am. In fact, I requested the honor myself.
Well, Emma and I appreciate your kindness. Don't we, honey?
The evening proved to be a much-needed tonic for Sarah. She didn't realize how much until she found herself laughing happily and clapping her hands to the music and whirling merrily in Braxton's arms when they waltzed. Lieutenant Braxton Bradley was more than convincing in his role as the perfect escort, and as the evening matured, she learned a great deal about the bachelor officer from Philadelphia, his ambitions, his hopes. Sarah could not help herself from admiring his jet-black hair that framed his perfectly proportioned face to form a classic profile as he guided Emma through the steps of a reel. It was not until the dance was over and she was saying her goodbyes to the other ladies who had made her feel so welcome that she suddenly was visited by a wave of guilt. She had no right to be enjoying herself, and she should have been wearing black instead of the print dress she had on, with Edward so recently departed. But she didn't even have a black dress. She immediately vowed to be more mindful of the respect she owed her late husband's memory. But then Braxton strode across the dance floor to walk her home, and his infectious smile made her forget her guilt. During the walk back to her wagon, under a clear night sky filled with stars, he asked her about her future plans. She confided that she had chosen to return to Westport simply because she didn't know what else to do.
I don't know anyone in Santa Fe, and at this point, I cannot say I have any definite plans once I return to Westport. Obviously, I can't stay here. Emma and I have a wagon and two horses, some household possessions, and that's all. Oh, listen to me. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to burden you with my troubles.
He seemed genuinely interested. When he had seen her and Emma safely back to the wagon, Sarah extended her hand.
Thank you for sacrificing yourself on my daughter and I's behalf. That was truly gentlemanly of you.
He took her hand.
If I'm not being too forward, might I see you again?
Later, when Sarah was trying to sleep, she would revisit this moment and question her reason for saying yes in answer to Braxton's request. It seemed innocent enough when he asked, and she felt it impolite to tell him no. But she would have doubts. She would lay awake for a long while, laboring with the guilt with which she chose to burden herself. Guilt for having enjoyed the evening immensely, and for a time, forgetting that she was recently widowed.
Oh, well, I'll be damned.
Ben Clark was shocked when Will ambled into headquarters at Camp Supply.
I thought you were dead. What's it been since you left here? 10 days?
9. I've got some dispatches here for the colonel.
9, then. It ain't but 90 miles to Fort Dodge. What did you do? Carry that horse on your back?
I ran into some trouble. Then I rode a piece with Lieutenant Bordeaux. Helped him with a little scouting on the way back. They've had some trouble with Cheyenne raiding parties pretty close into the fort. When I was done with that, I came on back here with dispatches from Fort Dodge.
Well, there wasn't much going on here anyway.
In fact, the only troop action scheduled for the next couple of days was a routine patrol south of the post.
Lieutenant Bridges is leading a patrol out toward Wolf Creek. Bill Belmer and Cody Johnson are going with him. You can go with him. Or you can ride dispatch again back to Fort Dodge.
Bridges again, huh? I expect I'll ride dispatch.
Yeah, I thought you might. First thing in the morning, then.
Mickey Bledsoe smiled when Will walked into the saloon.
Howdy, stranger. Where you been? I thought the engines might have got a hold of your scout.
Oh, I've been up to Dodge for a spell, just waiting till I could get back to drink some of your watered-down poison.
His remark was easily overheard in the compact saloon. Lula turned to verify the voice she thought she recognized. Seeing that it was indeed the tall, rugged scout, she moved her chair around to get a better view, a move that seemed to irritate the soldier who'd been plying her with Mickey's alcohol for the last damn half hour.
I knew you couldn't stay away for long.
Hello, Lula.
It would have been impossible to miss the couple at the table when he first walked in. And even though her back was to the door, Lula was easily identified by the expansive behind filling the chair. He also caught the deep scowl of irritation on her companion's face. And in view of that, he decided it best to turn his focus back to Mickey. Lula, however, was not content to let it go with nothing more than a nod in her direction. She had long envisioned a conquest of the untamed young scout, and she was willing to jeopardize a sure $3 transaction to pursue one that she might not even charge for. The slighted corporal was not at all pleased with her attention to the civilian scout, and grabbing her by the arm, he pulled her roughly back around in her chair.
By God, I'm the one's been buying you drinks here. And I'm thinking you ought to have enough in you by now to get you primed. Let's go in the back and have a tussle while I still got enough money left to pay for it.
Being a businesswoman, Lula decided she really couldn't afford to lose the corporal's money. So she tried to work the two parties to accomplish both goals.
Don't get cross with me, darling. I'm just saying hello to an old friend. You're gonna get your ride. Why don't you go on back in the room and I'll be there in a little old minute.
Hell, I will. We'll go back there together, and I mean right now.
All right, honey, we'll go now. I'll just speak to my friend on the way, all right?
I'll be damned.
Corporal pulled her up from her chair. Aware of the altercation at the table, both Mickey and Will chose not to notice as long as the situation didn't get out of hand. Will had no interest in anything Lula had to offer.
I'll just have a couple of short ones, Mickey, and then I'll be on my way. I'm leaving early in the morning.
Lula heard Will's remark.
Oh, don't leave till I get done here, Will. I won't be long and we can have a drink.
Damn you, bitch! I told you to get your fat ass in that room! Here.
The soldier grabbed the back of her dress, ripping it as he jerked her toward the door and causing her to stumble over a chair.
All right, soldier. I ain't gonna stand for that kind of roughhousing in my place.
Will walked over and helped Lula to her feet.
You all right?
Hell yes.
She turned to the corporal.
But you can get your sorry ass out of here. I wouldn't lay down for you for $100.
You cheating, double-dealing bitch!
Stepping between them, Will confronted the infuriated soldier.
Just hold it right there, corporal. This little misunderstanding is over. So there ain't no need to go any further with it. The lady has changed her mind about taking your money, so you'd best go on back to your barracks and sleep off some of that whiskey.
This ain't none of your business, and I'll break your damn back for you if you don't get out of my face.
A husky man, he drew back his fist and launched a wild punch at Will. Will quickly stepped back out of range.
Oh, I wish to hell you hadn't have done that. Now I reckon it is my business.
You son of a bitch!
The corporal went down.
Damn, Mickey. That boy's a handful.
Mickey came out from behind the bar, and together they dragged the corporal out of the saloon.
I guess I owe you a free ride for defending my honor with that bastard.
That's mighty nice of you, Lulu, darling. And hard for me to pass up. But I'm already late to report to the colonel, and I'd best be on my way before he sends somebody to look for me.
The look of disappointment on her face was unmistakable.
Working for the army sure takes up a man's free time.
Honey, you don't know what you're missing.
It was almost dusk when Will rode into Fort Dodge. He guided Spade straight to headquarters to deliver his dispatches, but his mind was firmly concentrating on the lone wagon parked in the trees near the riverbank. As quickly as he could, he gave the dispatches to the duty sergeant, then headed towards the wagon. On the way, he quickly tried to think about what he would say to her. Having finally given up on trying to convince himself that he had no serious thoughts toward Sarah, he spent almost the entire journey from Camp Supply deciding if he should tell her. Everything he had rehearsed on the ride had suddenly flown from his mind. But one thing he was sure of was his desire to marry Sarah Lawton. For a man who had wandered aimlessly all his life, there was now this one certainty. He told himself that it was maybe a little too early in their relationship, but the more he thought about it, the more sensible the arrangement seemed to be for all three parties. He was ready to change his aimless, free-roving lifestyle, and she needed someone to take care of her. And he was certain Emma would heartily approve. He was determined to express his feelings for her and her daughter, but he didn't want to be too bold since she had been a widow for such a short time.
I know it ain't been long since your husband died, but you need someone to take care of you, and things just happen a lot quicker out here on the frontier, or they have to. There's too much to take care of. Indians, drought, bad weather. You need a man. Emma needs a father, and... Oh, hell. I'll just tell her what's in my heart. It might be too soon to even think about it, but she needs to know what I'm thinking, and I'm willing to wait for her to decide.
Approaching the wagon, he could see the glow of a fire beyond it in the early twilight. He stopped within a dozen yards.
Hello, the wagon!
A small head peered around the tailgate of the wagon.
Will!
Within seconds, Emma was running to meet him. He leaned over in the saddle and reached down to scoop her up.
I knew you'd come back!
Oh, nothing could have kept me away, Whiskers. Where's your mama?
On the other side of the wagon. Well, she'll be glad to see you.
With a feeling that he was coming home, he guided Spades around the wagon and the tent next to it, where he found Sarah seated beside the fire on an army camp stool. The moment of joy he anticipated, however, was drowned in a flash by the sight of a young officer sitting with her, drinking coffee. Surprised and not quite certain what her feelings were at that moment, Sarah rose from the stool to greet her visitor.
Will, you came back. We were just having coffee. This is the man who rescued Emma and me. Will, this is Lieutenant Bradley.
Still in the saddle with Emma wrapped around his neck, Will was stunned and fighting hard not to show it.
Lieutenant, Will Kaysen.
The lieutenant rose and walked over to extend his hand.
Braxton Bradley.
Will shifted Emma around in order to shake Bradley's hand.
Would you care to step down and join us for coffee?
Yes, Will. Join us for coffee.
Emma gave Will's hand a squeeze.
We got a tent! Well, it's almost like living in a house.
Tearing his gaze away from Sarah, Will looked into the precocious child's face.
I see you do.
There was little doubt in his mind now as to where the tent and the camp stools had come from. Not only did Bradley look young and fit, he was handsome to boot. And Will had a sinking feeling that he was a fool to have entertained the slightest notion of wooing Sarah Lawton. At that moment, he had an urgent desire to run.
Thank you for the offer just the same, but I expect I'll be getting along. I just wanted to see if you folks were all right.
Oh, Will!
Will unlocked Emma's arms from his neck and lowered her gently to the ground.
Might have to go, Whiskers. I've got things to do. I'll come back to see you sometime when your ma ain't entertaining company. You make sure you take care of your ma now.
Please, Will, won't you stay and have some coffee?
No, thank you, Sarah. I'm kind of short on time. I'll drop by next time I'm around.
You're always welcome. Emma can't talk about you enough.
She's a special little lady. I'll try to come see her again. Ain't that a hell of a note? You damn fool, Kaysen. Lula's more your speed.
Knowing he could find a cot in the infantry barracks, he nevertheless guided Spades down along the riverbank, preferring his own company, intent upon putting some distance between his camp and the army post. As he rode, he tried to recall the scene at Sarah's campfire in detail. Maybe it wasn't as it seemed to him at the time. Maybe the lieutenant had merely been making a courtesy call. Maybe even under orders from the colonel.
Maybe I'll stop by in the morning.
It was difficult for Will to sleep that night. He couldn't seem to turn his mind off or prevent his thoughts from returning to Sarah. Could he have been so wrong? His instincts were usually reliable, but serious thoughts had never been spent on a woman before, and the possibility that he might one day marry had never occurred to him until Sarah. It seemed a natural union with Sarah and Emma, and his senses had told him that she might be thinking the same way. It was a troubling time for him, and it was not until the wee hours of the morning that he finally fell asleep. Riding back to the post the next morning, he was surprised to see an unusual amount of activity. It appeared a company-sized detail was already in the process of shaping up and falling into formation on the parade ground. Something was going on, and he decided he'd better see what it was. When he walked into the orderly room, Sergeant Major Boyle greeted him.
Where the hell have you been? I sent somebody looking for you an hour ago.
Well, I reckon they didn't look in the right place. What's going on?
Boyle explained that a rider had arrived at dawn carrying the news of an attack on a military scouting expedition near Pawnee Creek, not far from Fort Larned, another brazen raid close to an army post. The rider, a private, had made his way through the surrounding Cheyenne warriors, but he was faced with a second band of warriors between him and Fort Larned, so he rode all night to get to Dodge.
C Company is saddling up to go hunt for the raiders. I told Captain Fisher that you knew that country between here and Pawnee Fork better than anybody I know, so get your ass ready to go.
I'm as ready as I reckon I'll get. But Ben Clark is probably going to be looking for me to get back to supply.
Yeah, don't worry about that. I'll take care of Ben Clark. We'll most likely have somebody heading over that way in the next day or two. You'd best get on out there and report to Captain Fisher.
All right.
Fisher was talking to his officers, one of whom was Lieutenant Bordeaux. The lieutenant broke out in a wide grin as soon as he saw Will approaching.
Relax, boys! We're gonna be all right now!
Fisher, a serious man and one not familiar with Will, turned to cast a scrutinizing gaze upon the easy-riding scout on the bay horse. Kaysen had been highly recommended by Sergeant Major Boyle, but the captain had expected to see an older man. He frowned and continued to stare as Will pulled Spades to a halt before the circle of officers. With a grin and a nod, he gestured to Bordeaux.
You're Kaysen?
Yes, sir.
I've got good scouts, but Sergeant Major Boyle tells me you know the country better than most between here and Pawnee Creek. I hope he's right.
Fisher nodded toward the lieutenant, standing just to his right.
Lieutenant Gates is responsible for the scouts. You can report to him when we're finished here.
Will glanced at the officer indicated and nodded. Lieutenant Gates was a thin man with dark brown hair and a drooping mustache that just touched either side of his chin.
How soon are you going to pull out?
Inside 30 minutes, so be ready to ride.
Right.
Will met the captain's unblinking gaze and then looked back at Gates.
I've just got one little chore I've got to do, and I'll be ready.
Will turned spades and headed across the parade ground toward the lone wagon by the river. The possibility of a fight with Indians was not enough to take his mind from the visit he had decided to make the night before. Lieutenant Braxton Bradley was apparently assigned to another company since he was not among the group of officers surrounding Captain Fisher. Will was not sure whether that was good or bad. He wasn't eager to campaign with the lieutenant, but he wondered if he'd rather have him in the field with him instead of here with Sarah. Sarah was standing before the fire with a coffee cup in her hand when he rounded the corner of the tent. Emma saw him first, however, and she ran to meet him.
Will!
He climbed down from the saddle, and the little girl took his hand and led him to the fire.
I was just having one more cup of coffee before I went down to the river to wash some of our things. I'm sure there's a cup left in the pot.
That would go mighty good right now. I haven't had any this morning. I don't have but a minute or two. I got snagged by the sergeant major to go out with C Company, and they're about ready to leave now.
Sarah handed him the coffee.
Will, I'm so glad you stopped by this morning. I was afraid I'd seemed a little rude last night. You know, you'll always be welcome to visit Emma and me.
I think nothing of it. I didn't want to just barge in on your party.
Well, don't be silly. It wasn't a party. Braxton had just brought over these stools, and I made some coffee for him.
Feeling better about the situation already, he gulped his coffee down.
I wish I had more time to visit. I don't know how long I'll be gone on this scout. Might be a while. But I'll come back to see you as soon as I can, if that's all right.
Of course it's all right.
He paused a long moment, hesitating. He had been determined that he was going to express what was in his heart. But with Emma clutching his hand, he was not comfortable talking of such things in front of a child. Besides, there was no time.
Well, I'll see you when I see you.
Will handed her the cup and stepped up in the saddle. Turning spades around, he reached down and playfully ruffled Emma's hair.
Sarah, I got some things I won't tell you.
He gave spades a nudge and was off, relieved of the feeling from the night before. After talking it over with his scouts, Captain Fisher accepted the general opinion among them that the Cheyenne band that had attacked the patrol out of Fort Larned would probably head northwest toward Walnut Creek, possibly to join a larger village on the Smoky Hill. Will Kaysen confirmed the location of more than one village on that river, both Cheyenne and Arapaho, but he hadn't seen them since scouting that part of the country a month ago. All the same, it was a favorite camping place for both tribes, and Fisher decided to head out in that direction first. He had laid out a map to indicate the line of march to his scouts, Corporal Kincaid, one other soldier, and three civilians. Then he sent them forward about a quarter of a mile to each side. At Lieutenant Bordeaux's suggestion, the captain sent Will out alone to arrange about a mile ahead of the column. Will preferred to work that way, hoping to discover the presence of any hostiles before they spotted the cavalry column. It was close to noon on the second day out when Will came riding back to the column.
I think I found where they stopped to rest their horses after the attack, Captain Fisher.
You think you found it?
All right, I by God found where the war party stopped.
How far ahead?
2 miles, no more than that, on Walnut Creek.
Good. We can rest and water our horses there.
Once they reached Walnut Creek, Fisher gave permission for the men to build small fires to make coffee while the horses were watered. Will let Spades drink, then drifted over to share coffee with Corporal Kincaid and Lieutenant Bordeaux, while Captain Fisher searched the banks of the creek, looking at tracks and any other sign that might give him any information about the war party he was chasing. A waste of time by Will's thinking. By this time, there was a confusion of tracks with shod cavalry hooves mixed with those of unshod Indian ponies. When he had finished, having found exactly nothing that would be of any use to him, Fisher walked over to stand before Will, who was stretched out beneath a tree drinking his coffee.
Shouldn't you be scouting this area for information that might tell us where they went from here?
Don't need to.
Why not?
Already done it. I looked it over before I went back to get you, so you and your soldiers wouldn't trample all over what sign there was.
Will turned to point toward the cottonwoods behind him.
They rode out of here between those two big trees yonder, headed for the Smoky Hill. That's where we knew they were headed all along.
All right. We'll rest here long enough for the men to get some coffee and a little something to eat. How far are we from the Smoky Hill?
About 35 miles, I expect. I doubt you could make it before dark without running the horses into the ground.
Fisher nodded thoughtfully. He was considering a night march to get into position to launch a dawn attack on the village, as Custer had done on Black Kettle's village on the Washita. Somehow, sensing what the captain might be speculating, Will offered a gentle reminder.
Of course, I don't know where this bunch's village is on the Smoky Hill, so I can't say how far it is to their village. Only how far to the Smoky Hill.
We'll rely on you to find that village in the morning.
Fisher glanced at Bordeaux, then raised an eyebrow.
I'm beginning to think you were right, Harvey.
Then he turned to leave him. Bordeaux's grin returned to his face, for he knew what Fisher meant. The lieutenant had advised the captain earlier that Will was the best scout in the regiment. A gentle mist lay upon the slowly moving water as the sun climbed up from the prairie behind him. Spade's ears flickered constantly, searching the quiet morning air for sounds of other life. They had been there, but they were gone now. Will nudged Spades with his heels, and the patient bay stepped slowly down into the water. Climbing the bank on the other side, he reined the gelding back for a few moments while he surveyed the empty circles where teepees had once stood. Then he prodded his horse again and slowly walked it through the pattern of circles. He counted 42 lodges, and from the dead grass within the circles, he knew that the village had been there for some time. Tracks from horses and lodge poles following the river west also told him that the village had moved no more than one or two days ago, apparently almost as soon as the war party returned. All this told Will that the hostile Cheyenne expected a sizable detachment of soldiers to follow him, and they most likely were seeking to join another village farther along the river. The question facing Captain Fisher would now be the strength of the combined villages. It might be more than a company of cavalry could handle.
I'd best get on back and tell him his village is moved.
Spades leaped forward to plunge into dark water when Will gave him a firm kick. Off to his right, Will saw three warriors riding along the bluffs in an effort to cut him off.
Get me out of here, boy!
Charging up from the water, he scaled the opposite bank and threaded his way through the willows at a full gallop. Will looked for the first reasonable cover he thought he could defend, and he hoped there were no more warriors behind the three that were shooting at him now. The problem facing him was the gentle rolling terrain of the prairie stretching out before him. Will knew that Spades would continue his present pace until he fell dead as a result. Determined not to let that happen, Will headed for a low mound with two lone trees standing on the crest. It did not offer the best of cover, but it was the best he could see. He jumped from the saddle. Taking a quick assessment of the spot he had landed in, he led the bay behind the highest point of the mound, which was still not high enough to shield the entire horse. Snatching his rifle from the saddle, along with an ammunition belt, he scrambled up behind one of the two trees. When they were well within the range of his rifle, he took careful aim. The death of one of the attackers was enough to cause the other two to veer away sharply and seek cover of their own. With little to choose from, they took refuge behind a low, grassy hummock. Both parties realized the fight was little more than a waste of cartridges. Neither side was willing to stick their heads up. It was apparent now that there had been no more than the three, a fact that was encouraging to Will. It eliminated the threat of being surrounded, especially Key, since Will had no cover behind him. In addition, to get around behind him, one of the two would have to come out from behind that hummock. And at this short range, he'd be dead the moment he showed. With none of the combatants knowing how to gain an advantage, an extended standoff was the result, and now it was a matter of who had the most patience. Either side could safely withdraw by backing away, but Will knew that would only result in another chase to another standoff, and Spades was already tired.
I reckon I'll just sit here and wait for the cavalry.
He wasn't sure about the two civilian scouts with the column. He'd never ridden with them before. But he was confident Corporal Kincaid could follow the same trail he had followed to find the village. As the sun climbed higher in the sky, the morning began to heat up considerably, and he began to think about the canteen hooked over his saddle horn.
Should have thought about that when I grabbed my rifle.
Now, he was reluctant to slide back away from the tree to fetch it, afraid he might draw fire toward his horse. So he shrugged off his thirst and continued to watch the hummock, hoping for a target. A full hour passed. Then, Will spotted the forward scouts cresting a small rise about 50 yards away. He recognized the familiar figure of Corporal Kincaid. A smile of relief appeared on his face.
Saved by the cavalry.
Returning his attention to his immediate problem, he saw the two warriors sliding away from the brink of the hummock. Knowing he would probably get a chance for at least one clear shot, he inched up closer to the tree trunk and set his rifle in a position to fire. As he suspected, the two Indians couldn't retreat from their position without exposing themselves and their horses. Expecting them to jump on their ponies and bolt away as quickly as possible, he was surprised when they walked out from behind the hummock using the three horses as cover. First, he aimed at their legs, which he could see under the horses' bellies. He decided against it, then thought about shooting the horses, but he didn't pull the trigger. He was kind of soft when it came to shooting horses. Then, curious to see how far they would walk before jumping on their ponies, he watched as they continued across his field of fire until he realized they were intent upon retrieving the body of the one he had killed. He would chastise himself later for being so soft-hearted, but he decided to let him pick up the body and leave. His thoughts occupied with his frustration over the Indians' actions, Will then remembered the troopers behind him. In a few seconds, Kincaid rode up to him and stopped.
You all right, Will?
Yeah, I'm all right. How far back are they?
About a quarter mile. Ought to be showing up directly.
That Cheyenne village was here, on the other side of the river. But looks like they cleared out about the time the war party got back.
Will paused then when the point rider of the detachment appeared in the distance.
I expect this bunch here decided to move on up the river to join forces with another village. Don't know how many warriors they can scrape up, but I expect it'll be considerable more than Fisher was expecting to fight.
Well, I ain't paid to think. But if I was, I'd be damn careful about marching on the next village.
Both men knew that the column of cavalry could be seen for miles on the open prairie. So if the Cheyenne decided to fight, it would be because they were equal to or greater in number than the soldiers. Captain Fisher and his officers listened to Will's report and decided to rest and water the horses at the site of the former Cheyenne village. Since there had been no stops since starting out that morning, He ordered the men to prepare their noonday meal. After some consideration, he talked to Will.
Kaysen, I need to know how far that next village is and their strength. Those two you say got away will report our strength.
Yes, sir. But I doubt if those two know how many men we've got. All they saw was the forward scouts.
I hope you're right. Get yourself something to eat first.
Yes, sir. I will.
Will joined Kincaid and several others to make coffee and cook some salt pork. Filling the battered old metal cup he had carried for years, he sat back and let his mind wander. Released to float unhampered, it drifted to thoughts of Sarah Lawton, and that brought him a sense of contentment. He thought about his farewell a few days earlier. There were no overt statements from her, but her manner told him that he'd be in her thoughts as well. In all his life, he could never remember ever having thought about being married and having a family. He'd always blown with the wind with no responsibilities beyond himself and his horse, and no worries about the day following the one he was in. But hell, that didn't mean he couldn't change when the time was right, and that time was now.
Well,
the image of Sarah when she took his coffee cup and said goodbye made him smile.
Will!
What?
Damn, Will, I thought you'd gone deaf for a minute. What the hell was you thinking about? You were grinning like a dog eating briars.
Nothing. Just thinking about how good this coffee was.
Will got to his feet and tossed out the dregs of his cup. Picking up his coffee pot, he swirled the contents around.
There's a swallow or two left. You own it?
Kincaid stuck his cup out to accept the last bit of the bitter black liquid.
Well, I'd best get in the saddle and go see what kind of trouble I can find for you soldier boys.
And watch you don't get an arrow up your ass.
An entire Indian village on the move leads a wide trail, one easily followed by most anyone. Will was not concerned with actually scouting the trail. He knew the Cheyenne had followed the river west, staying close to the water. It was just a matter of how far they had gone. The country the Smoky Hill wound through at this point was a vacant-looking prairie once you left the river, with barren bluffs of chalk in the distance. It was a land that looked incapable of supporting life, dotted with occasional formations of limestone and chalky towers. Yet he knew it sustained buffalo and antelope on its seemingly endless sea of grass, and it had long been a favorite camping site for Cheyenne and Arapaho bands. Aware of the potential for ambush by the two hostiles who had just fled, he held close to the tree line along the river, cautious, although he thought the possibility unlikely. Dusk came, and then darkness. Still, he pushed on, following the river under a starry sky, content to continue as long as Spades was showing no signs of fatigue. Finally, he decided that he'd pushed his horse far enough, and he began looking for the best place to camp. It was then, after rounding a bend in the river, that he saw the rosy glow against the dark night sky. A glow caused by the many campfires of an Indian village.
Let's get a little closer and have a look, boy.
Closer now, he could tell that the village was on the same side of the river he was. So when he came to a place that looked to be a good spot to ford, he crossed over to the other side and continued to get closer still. When within 100 yards of the outermost lodges, he left Spades tied in the trees and made his way even closer on foot. It was a big camp. It looked to be larger than the band he'd been following. And even though it was too difficult to count lodges from across the river, it stood to reason that it was the 42 teepees he had counted downriver. After judging by the activity in the center of the village, it was easy to guess that they were getting ready for war. Still moving cautiously through a stand of willows, he worked his way along the bank paralleling the camp. He finally decided that he had a fair estimate of the number of warriors that C Company, with its strength of 70, counting officers and non-coms, would be facing. Making a conservative guess, he figured the soldiers were going to be outnumbered by more than 2-1. Those odds might not be critical if the Indians were armed with bows and a few muzzle loaders, but based on what had been the case with Lieutenant Bordeaux's patrol against some of these same Cheyenne, the soldiers would be facing well-armed hostiles, many carrying repeating rifles. Fisher might find himself dealing with a real hornet's nest.
Well, all I can do is tell him what I saw. I ain't paid to think either.
When the dancing finally came to an end, he turned to reverse his course and head back to his horse. He couldn't tell Fisher what the Cheyenne had in mind, but they were preparing for something. They were no longer running, that much was apparent. So Will had to figure they somehow knew the strength of the cavalry troops looking for him and felt that their warriors were capable of defending the villages. Making his way back the way he'd come along the riverbank, he suddenly stopped short when he came to the stand of willows where he had left Spades. A Cheyenne warrior had untied Spades' reins. The horse backed away, almost dragging the Indian as it did. Realizing that the man was not aware that he was behind him, Will remained dead still while he quickly glanced around the darkened thicket to make sure the warrior was alone. Convinced that the Indian had stumbled upon Spades by chance, he knew that he must act quickly before the warrior alerted the village, and he had to do it quietly. He considered using his rifle as a club, but he decided against it because of the uncertainty of landing a solid enough blow on the back of the man's head, allowing him to cry out. So he carefully leaned the rifle against the bush and drew his skinning knife from his belt. Carefully placing each foot, he moved toward the warrior, who was still trying to calm Spades, a task that was rapidly becoming more difficult because the horse now recognized Will approaching and looked for him to intercede. Unfortunately, the Cheyenne was astute enough to realize something had further excited the horse, and just as Will was about to strike, he turned and discovered the white scout. Both men reacted instantly, rushing together with such force that the collision of their bodies caused them to go crashing to the ground. Rolling over and over, almost getting trampled under Spades' hooves, they struggled for advantage, with neither able to overpower the other. The Indian managed to draw his knife, but Will caught his wrist in one hand. Both men strained mightily to force the other to drop his knife, but to no avail. Each knowing that the penalty for yielding was death. In a desperate attempt to end the stalemate, and fearing that it might only be a matter of time before someone else from the village would happen upon him, Will forced the Indian over on his back. Trying to pin his arm to the ground with his knee, he suddenly released his grip on his wrist and smashed his face. Slowly, Will forced his knife arm up until the knife blade was touching the warrior's neck. Will forced himself to move, pausing only briefly to give Spades an accusing look for causing the warrior to turn to confront him.
Whose side are you on?
Indifferent to the question, the bay gelding followed him back to the bush to fetch his rifle, and with legs still weak from the terrible strain, Will climbed up in the saddle. Intent now upon putting some distance between him and the combined Cheyenne villages, he retraced his path along the river.
Damn, look what the cat drug in.
Harvey Bordeaux got up from the blanket he'd been seated upon to greet the rangy scout as Will walked Spades through the camp toward him.
You look like hell.
Harvey listened to Will's accounting of the fight with the Cheyenne warrior in open-eyed astonishment.
Damn, Will. You want some coffee?
I sure do. About a barrel of it. I should report to Captain Fisher right away. But I swear, I need this first.
Where'd you find him?
Oh, I found him all right. About 200 warriors, if I had to guess. And they looked like they were getting worked up to go to war.
Oh, that doesn't sound too good. And they must have joined up with a bigger village.
Mm-hmm. That's a fact.
Will was stopped from elaborating by the appearance of Captain Fisher striding toward him.
The customary protocol is for a scout to report to the commanding officer as soon as possible.
Bordeaux turned his face away for a moment as he tried to suppress a smile. Winking at Will, he turned back to address Fisher.
I'm afraid it's my fault for stopping him, Captain. He was on his way to find you.
Indeed I was. But I got tripped up by the smell of that coffee pot. I didn't take time to make any breakfast this morning. Figured you'd want to find out what those engines were up to, so I came straight on in.
Well, let's have it, man.
The captain listened as Will made his report, giving him a complete picture of the situation facing him. Like Will, Fisher would not have been concerned about the disadvantage in numbers if the hostiles were not armed as well as his troopers. There was no way Will could give him a report on exactly how many of the 200 or so warriors were armed with rifles, and how many of those were seven-shot repeating carbines, like the weapons used against Bordeaux's patrol. To withdraw without engaging the enemy was not a palatable option for the conscientious officer. But he was also not eager to throw his man into a skirmish that would result in heavy losses. He couldn't lose sight of his orders to follow the band that ambushed the patrol out of Fort Larned and punish them. His decision was a difficult one, and he gave it a lot of thought before making it.
How far to that village?
About a day, unless they're thinking about coming to meet you.
You think that's what they've got in mind?
Don't know. They might, though, when they find that dead Indian by the river.
Dead Indian?
Yes, sir. I had to kill one. He caught me by surprise, and I didn't have no choice.
You think they know how many men we have?
Well, I can't say. All I can tell you is what I saw, and they were getting all fired up about something. It sure looked to me like a war dance. Of course, I reckon when they find that body on the riverbank, they'll know somebody was spying on them. I doubt they'll think he committed suicide.
Fisher frowned, unappreciative of Will's humor. He thought the situation over for a long moment. Finally, he submitted to pride and a sense of duty.
Break camp! Prepare to move out!
After informing his officers of the line of march, he turned to Will.
I want you to go back out front and keep your eyes open. I don't want to march this company into a damn ambush.
Yes, sir.
You'd best take a man with you. You might have to send word back.
Yes, sir. I won't borrow Kincaid again.
You've got him. Corporal Kincaid?
A couple dozen yards distant, in the process of saddling his horse, Kincaid looked back when he heard his name called. Seeing Will, he grinned.
Hey, there's that fellow that's always trying to get me scalped. I reckon you men will have to do without me to hold your hands.